And you all got it, just like that. Fantastic. Okay, Matthew chapter 24. If you want to get a fight going among folks, read Matthew 24. And you'll get all kinds of opinions. I'm going to do something tonight, though, that I hope will be beneficial to you. I'm not producing any charts. I'm not trying to make any predictions or anything like that. What we're going to do is we're actually going to look at the text and do our best to understand what Jesus was saying. A lot of preference work that we need to do, or the preface of a book that we need to do first, kind of lay the groundwork. The scene has changed. For the last 3 weeks, we've been in the temple. Jesus is teaching there. He's been confronted by his religious opponents, scribes, Pharisees, Sadducees, a lawyer, all of that, an expert in Jewish law, that's what a lawyer was. He's been dealing with them, and he's even confronted them on some of their ideas and their beliefs. Now, though, he's moved. He's no longer in the temple. He has moved across the Kidron Valley. He's up on what is referred to as the Mount of Olives. On the side of the Mount of Olives, there's an olive grove. Not a garden, but an olive grove. And there in the midst of that olive grove, somewhere there in that olive grove, there is a Gethsemane, an olive press. And we'll talk more about that when we get a little bit further into Matthew, more toward the end. So that's where Jesus and his disciples, apparently, that's where they've been staying. He's been staying there at night. In the daytime, he's been going to the temple. But now he's back over. He's on the Mount of Olives. Maybe it's in the evening, that we don't know. But there, when you stand on the Mount of Olives, which is not a mountain like we think of a mountain out west, it's a hill, and it's a range of hills that stretches. But across from the temple complex, the temple mound, you go across the Kidron Valley, and it's a very steep little valley. And you come back up on the other side, you are on the Mount of Olives. So they're sitting undoubtedly in a place where they can see the temple itself. Okay, that's what they see. So Jesus, as it says in verse 1 of 24:1, as Jesus left and was going out of the temple, his disciples came up and called his attention to the buildings. Now, the first thing, they're on their way out of the temple area, and for whatever reason, the disciples, it was one or more, doesn't really specify, but they state that something about the temple itself, the structure. He replied to them, "Do you see all of these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone will be left on another that will not be thrown down." Now that's a prophetic statement Jesus is making. 40 years. Approximately, from the time that Jesus said this, it would be fulfilled. AD 66, in Caesarea, there was an uprising among the Jews. The uprising continued to spread. And then 4 years later, after the initial uprising began, Titus, the Roman general, later he'd be a Caesar, but Titus, the Roman general, along with the Roman army, came into Jerusalem and besieged it. According to Josephus, it was an absolute bloodbath. And for the next 3 years after that, the Romans continued putting down the Jewish rebellion. The last place to fall was a place that's not mentioned in the Bible, but it is just on the west side of the Dead Sea. It is called Masada. You may have heard of Masada. That was the last Jewish holdout. And it was a fortress for King Herod, and it was one that could not be breached. But the Romans eventually breached it by building a siege wall up to finally being able to reach, because otherwise it was just called the snake's path that went at the side of the mountain. And somebody with a bucket of rocks could have kept an army away because of how strong the fortress actually was. It even had two walls around it. Fascinating place. Matter of fact, to this day, when a young man and a young woman, when they're sworn in to the Israeli army, well, you know where they're sworn in at? On Masada. Just to keep that patriotic spirit going, because that was the last Jewish holdout. Jesus said, it's coming. It's coming. He's already indicated that. Remember when he was weeping over Jerusalem? Oh, Jerusalem, oh, Jerusalem. How often I would have gathered you together as a hen gathers her chicks, but you would not. That also was predictive of what was going to take place. If you would have known the hour of your visitation, but it's been hidden from your eyes. So that's kind of the setting going on. So they're leaving. Now they're going to, when Jesus starts talking after this, they're on the Mount of Olives, but they're on their way there right now. I'm going to show you just a few photographs and then a short video. I want you to get the feeling of why these disciples were amazed. What was so amazing about this structure? So, well, you give me a minute to get it up and going, and then you'll see what I'm talking about. All right, now that's a photograph of when we were there in 2017. Let me show you what you're looking at. You're looking at an old wall. Some of it is dates from the time of Jesus, but the very top part dates from about 1,400 years ago. Or, no, less than that. How about that, I guess. And it was built by Muslims when the Ottoman Empire swallowed up Jerusalem. Then it was under the control of the Muslims. You will see right here, you see those rocks? And right over there? Those have been excavated since probably about 20, 25 years ago. What happens is, earth accumulates. So what we're standing on right here, this stone pavement, that's first century pavement. In other words, Jesus and his disciples walked on that very pavement. But it was covered up because of the debris and then the soil and everything over the years. So it's been excavated. Those rocks, that's where they fell. They haven't been moved. Now, some of the rocks had been reclaimed to shore up the wall by the Muslims. So the actual pile would have been much more than what you see there. That's one view of it. Here's another view. You can see that pile of stones right there. Many of those broke. Falling down from the height of that of the wall. You can still see the stones here. These stones up through there, up to that lip, that's first century. Herod was responsible for that. It's fascinating that those stones are not put together with any kind of adhesive, no concrete or anything like that. They're held together by gravity. So that's a couple of views that you see there. That's more of a close-up. It's interesting. You see this area right here? Can anybody see my finger? Right here, this area right there? Anybody see that besides me when I point to you? All right, speak up. That's all right. I know you're away. All right. That was apparently what Herod wanted done. The stones are not necessarily smooth, but this area at one time was very smooth. It made it very ornate. How'd they do that? Well, they were really good at what they were doing. Now, the next will be the short video that I want you to see. And just listen to the fellow that is talking about it, because this is, when you look at the stones, that stone you're looking at right there, it's huge. It's huge. It might weigh 80, 90 tons. It's a bigger thing. I should have had Tara stand by it, so you get an idea of what I'm talking about. But this next stone you're going to see, it's amazing. And well, I'll say enough. I'll go ahead and get to it.
Is the same Western Wall we can see outside. It's the continuation of it. We're not standing on top of it or beneath it or on the other side of it, just along the same wall, but where it's concealed, where it's hidden. If you look over here at the bottom and with your gaze slowly climb up to the top, you will notice different kinds of construction. You're looking at two different periods. 1400 years ago, when the Muslims first came here, they find parts of the wall ruined, destroyed. They decide to renovate. These small stones over here and the larger ones above them, all the way to the top, is 1,400-year Muslim renovation. But from here and all the way down to the valley, we're talking about four stories beneath us, this beautiful symmetric-shaped stone with this nice frame around it, aligned so neatly, one near each other and one on top of the other, with no cement in between to glue the stones together. We call this dry construction, kind of like Lego. This is 2,000-year-old Jewish construction. So look at me, don't follow me. I want to show you something. From here, and all the way, going 40 feet along the Western Wall, 40 feet, that is longer than a bus, you're looking at the largest stone found in the Temple Mount. It is 12 feet high and 14 feet deep. It weighs close to 600 tons. That's equivalent to like, I would say 200 elephants, or if you want it in a modern scale, two airplanes. The big jumbo jet, transatlantic 747, with the people and the luggage after shopping in Israel. That's heavy, yeah. Two big airplanes, one stone, and the big question is how? How do they carve a stone like this? How do they roll it here? How do they lift it up and place it so accurately? I believe a good question deserves even a better answer. The answer is, we don't know. Physicists, mathematicians, archaeologists, engineers, historians, today, don't know how, with the lack of technology they had 2,000 years ago, they were able to move something so big. This is a mystery, an enigma. But there is one story I can share with you about the stone. When Titus destroys the city, he sees this big stone. As a tactician, as a general, he understands perfectly the symbolic value that the stone has for the Jewish people, for their moral and pride and self-esteem. So you have to try to imagine him telling his soldiers, guys, we need to destroy this because we need to break the Jews not only physically, but also mentally, psychologically, spiritually, emotionally. Try to imagine Roman soldiers standing way above us, pushing stones from the wall down to the marketplace below us, stone after stone, row after row, until they get to this big stone. When they do, they huff, they puff, the stone doesn't budge. They try to break it, they try to destroy it. But luckily for us, in the end, instead of them breaking the stone pretty much broke them. And they left us this amazing 2,000-year-old testimony.
Okay. You kind of get maybe a little bit of flavoring why the disciples were somewhat amazed at what they were looking at. Unbelievable construction. Amazing. That sets up one of the most significant statements that Jesus makes, or teaching that he offers. Mark talks about it. Luke includes it. Now, John doesn't, but it's called the Olivet Discourse in Matthew's Gospel. And it begins here, it goes into chapter 25, 26, and we'll be dealing with those things. Now, having said that, let's move a little bit further, because you can see where the scene has now shifted. They were moving toward, away from the temple. Now they're on the Mount of Olives. And it says in verse 3, while he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples approached him privately and said, tell us, when will these things happen? When will one stone no longer be on top of another? And secondly, And what is the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Now there's a couple things we need to affirm right off the bat. Some would suggest there's three questions here. Actually, I believe there's only two. The first question that the disciples asked Jesus to answer is this one. When? When will this happen? The second question is, what? What is a sign of your coming? And I think that the second part of that statement, or that question, is basically the same time frame when it says, and the end of the age. Because they believed, Jewish theology was, that there was a general resurrection of everyone, both good and evil, on the last day. So in their minds, when they're asking this question, that's what they're thinking. And Jesus, in Jewish fashion, rabbinical fashion, is going to address that. He's addressing two questions. Two questions. What and when? So as we go through this particular chapter, keep in mind these two words. When is this going to happen? And what will be the sign of your coming? And then he goes on from there. Now, I know that there are those that will draw charts, and some of those charts are helpful when you bring in other scriptural passages trying to frame this. But we need to be a little bit cautious about always doing that. Okay? And why we need to be cautious about it, I think if we're not careful, one of the things that we will do is we will import a lot of other things into what is being said here. So what I'm trying to do tonight is I'm not looking at it from taking a holistic approach, taking all these other passages and reflecting on this. What I want to do is I want to deal with these two questions. When is it going to be? And what is going to be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? So it's the when and the what. Okay, you got that pretty much? Hopefully we'll find at least some of our time fruitful. Now, if we wanted to, of course, and had the opportunity to, we could bring in a lot of other passages of Scripture to bear upon what is being said here. And that's where the charts and all the other kind of things really start coming in. So I hope that's a game plan that you're comfortable with. But I think before we can go to that next step, we need to first understand what, as best we can, what's going on here. Remember last week I told you that kind of a Jewish method of teaching is, you know, that they have the subject matter right there and they talk around it. You're going to see that. You're going to see that in Matthew chapter 24. You're going to see Jesus sliding, as it were, between these two questions. He's going to talk about this question, and then he's going to talk about something else. He's going to come back and talk about it again. Hopefully you'll see what I'm talking about as we work our way down through here. All right. So Jesus replied to them, "Watch out." First thing he says, "Watch out that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name saying, 'I am the Christ,' or 'I am the Messiah,' and they will deceive many." For many will come in my name saying, "I am Messiah," and they will deceive many. And you are going to hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed, because these things must take place, but the end is not yet. Okay, you got that? So Jesus is pointing out that there's going to be some things that's going to be taking place. Now he's going to talk about, he's really dealing with the what. They want to know when the end is going to be and what will be the sign of his coming. And he says, now listen, there are going to be many false messiahs, and they're going to rise up, many, and they're going to deceive a lot of people. You're going to hear of wars and rumors of wars. But be understood that when these things happen, it's not the end. Okay, got that? Check mark? It's not the end. He goes on, for nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these events are the beginning of birth or labor pains. Just the beginning. So when you look at the chaos does not necessarily indicate that the end is upon us. Okay? But what it does indicate is that it's the beginning of these birth pains. Now, let's take the metaphor that he uses here, birth pains. When our first child was born, Jordan, he was born in the middle of the night. Every one of my kids was born on really kind of on Sunday, but you know, actually be Monday morning. All of them in the middle of the night. Well, Tara stayed home from church that day. She skipped church because she felt like she probably ought to skip church. So she did. So I get home, and her mother's there with her. And she's sitting in the gliding rocking chair. Matter of fact, the one we had back here in the nursery is the one, the gliding rocking chair that we had at the time. And she was sitting there, and every once in a while, you know, I tried to talk to her. She wouldn't talk back. She just didn't say anything. And I was trying to have fun with it. I had a video camera videoing her, you know. Thought she'd want to see that one day. You know what's getting ready, what's happening, right? There's labor pains. What does that mean? Well, it means you're going to be a baby before very long born, right? You got that. That's the picture. That's what he's saying. He's saying something that these guys, as dense as they are, he's saying something, oh, yeah, I get it. It's not the end, but be aware it is the beginning of the end. So we're somewhere in there. Okay, so we're talking about the, you know, not the exact when, but what's going to be happening. But it's not the end yet. So he's kind of dealing with both the what and the when in this particular few verses. Verse 9. And they will hand you over to be persecuted, and they will kill you, and you will be hated by all nations because of my name. Then many will fall away, betray one another, and hate one another. Many false prophets will rise and deceive many, because lawlessness will multiply. The love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. The good news of the kingdom will be proclaimed to all the world as a testimony to all nations. And then the end will come. So now he's answering the when question. Okay? So he's telling when the end is going to come. Well, when is the end going to come? Is it because of the chaos in the world? No, that is the beginning of birth pains. So when is it going to come? Well, notice what he says here in verse 14. The good news, this good news, the gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed to all the world as a testimony to all the nations. And then the end will come. Okay, we've got that part. That's partially answering that question of the when. When will these things be? But also, you know, telling them what will be the sign. Well, the sign he's talking about here is when the gospel is worldwide aware. Now, we're pretty, you know, you can think about now is probably, it seems like it's pretty well worldwide. At least the information is available now. Through social media, through the internet, and that kind of thing. And that's certainly a factor, and certainly a help to be sure. But it's amazing how many people still don't know what the gospel even is. Even in the United States. Don't assume that everyone knows who Billy Graham was, or that they know what the gospel is. Or even if they've heard it. You'll be surprised. How many people really don't, for whatever reason, have a knowledge of what we're talking about? Okay, so you with me so far? He's going to talk more. So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then those in Judea must flee to the mountains. A man on a housetop must not go down and get things out of his house. And a man in the field must not go back and get his coat. Woe to pregnant women and nursing mothers in those days. Pray that your escape may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. For at that time there will be great distress, the kind that hasn't taken place from the beginning of the world until now, and never will again. Now that's, I don't know if you have it marked in your Bible or not, but I certainly have verse 21 highlighted, because it frames this section that Jesus is talking about in a way that is unmistakable. Number one, whatever he is referring to, it has never happened in the past. Whatever he's referring to will never happen again. Okay? So you will find that if you have headings in your Bible or footnotes, you may find footnotes that suggest that this is talking about the Great Tribulation. Because the Jewish people have experienced very, very harsh periods of history. But this is going to extend beyond the severity of anything that's ever happened. The Holocaust is not as bad as this is going to be. It's his own words. Now, I'm not framing this yet in any kind of date or anything like that. He's been talking about what's culture going to be like. There's going to be false messiahs, deceived people. There's going to be wars and rumors of wars. Nations going to rise against nation. There's going to be earthquakes and famines. There's going to be all these things. But now he's framing it with a little more precision by pointing out there's going to be a time of suffering that is far beyond anything that has ever happened in the past or will ever happen again. That really limits the scope of what we can attach these verses to. And that's why most will land on the idea that this is the Great Tribulation. Now, again, just to kind of connect with that just a little. You see other biblical prophecies, and I told you I wasn't going to get into a lot of the other things at this point, but I think it is to your advantage and our advantage understanding that we do deal with that just some. Okay? Now, Book of Daniel. The Book of Daniel alludes to it. It alludes to that period in Daniel's 70th week. Daniel talks about those kind of things. Now, the thing when you're reading the Book of Daniel that a lot of people, I think, make an error in understanding is Daniel is instructed that what he is seeing in his vision there, what he is learning from the angel, it is for your people. Whose people? Daniel's people, who are whom? The Jews. Keep that in mind. Because when you get to the book of Revelation, you've got a worldwide thing going on. But who is a particular, what people group is a particular focus? Is Jews. It is Jews. It's the Jewish people. You call it Jacob's trouble, that period there of that history. But whatever we're talking about, wherever you try to place it in the future, it's going to be something that is so bad, it is so worse than anything that has ever happened in the past. Okay? And again, not nailing it down to any kind of chronology other than to point that out. He goes on. These words emphasize the level of severity of what we're talking about. Unless those days were cut short, no one, no flesh, would be saved. But those days will be cut short because of the elect. If anyone tells you, see, here is the Messiah,
not believe it. For false messiahs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders and to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. And again, you remember what I told you about talking around it? You see it again? Jesus now, we've already looked at the false, or we mentioned the false messiahs, and that deceives many. He's returned to it again. You see, what he's done is, in one sense, he has jumped into the future, talking about what we would refer to as the Great Tribulation, but now he's come back, talking about these false prophets and false messiahs. And he says, if anyone tells you, see, here is the Christ, or over there, do not believe it. For false messiahs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. And he says, take note, I have told you in advance. So if they tell you, see, he is in the wilderness, don't go out. Or see, he is in the storerooms, do not believe it. For as lightning comes from the east and flashes as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Remember what was that original question that they asked? Or questions? Remember? When will these things happen? And what is a sign of your coming and of the end of the age? In other words, his coming will be unmistakable. No confusion here. No one wondering about it. When he comes, it will be clear. As lightning flashes from one side of the sky to the other, so will the Son of Man's coming be. It will be unmistakable, in other words. Okay? And then he ends with verse 28 of this particular section of teaching. Wherever the carcass is, there the vultures, maybe you have translated says, there the eagles will gather. Okay? Now, let's take a pause. And if you have something to offer or a question to ask, I'm not saying I can answer it, but yes.
In verse 24, are you saying that referred to his first coming? He was talking to the disciples and that time there was going to be false messiahs?
No, he's still looking forward. There are going to be, there's, you know, for false messiahs and false prophets will, that's in the future, will arise. And they'll perform great signs and wonders, and many people will be deceived and follow after them. And Jesus says, just let you know, don't get caught up thinking that this person who may be a charismatic personality, may have a great following, he's not the Messiah. Don't even give him, in one sense, a second thought. Yes?
And back in verse 21, you had mentioned that a lot of what being talked about, both here and back in Daniel, was aimed or directed to the Jews. So is the Great Tribulation only for the Jews?
They are the focal point. No, it's going to be, it's much broader than that.
See...
I struggled with this for a lot of years, and I'm not saying I've fully come to understanding or as well. But sometimes, I've had the question, well, where's America in biblical prophecy? It's not there.
That's right.
You just might as well acknowledge it. It's not there, because the focus of biblical prophecy, in this sense, this kind of prophecy, it's the Jewish nation. That's why, one of the reasons why, I reject the notion that God is through with Israel. I reject it because it doesn't fit the Scripture. I know there are brothers and sisters that are Bible-believing folks that believe that God is done with Israel. And that actually...
what Israel is supposed to do now, God is kind of working through Christianity, the church, in order to accomplish those things. And there's a variety of notions that are attached to that. I cannot embrace that. I cannot embrace that. In Romans chapters 9, 10, and 11, Paul is dealing with, what about the Jews? What about them? And in that context, you will find that Paul is talking about the Gentiles are grafted in. We're the wild olive. We're not the tame one. The tame one, of course, is the Jewish people. We've been grafted into them, not that they have been grafted into us. And that God could remove that wild stem just as much if he so chose to do it. But he gets that there's a I think it's verse 29 of chapter 10, I think. It says the promises and the choosing of God are irrevocable. Something that, I'm not giving you a direct quote. I'm messing up on it. The calling and the gifts of God are irrevocable. What does irrevocable mean? No. So what he promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, God is still going to honor. He's going to honor. He has to. And even Paul, the apostle to the Gentiles, acknowledges that. So I'm not saying that I'm not going as far as John Hagee. And I would recommend that you not pay a whole lot of attention to John Hagee. But John Hagee, kind of tongue-in-cheek, he believes there's two ways to be saved. Trust Christ or be a Jew. No, Jews are saved the same way we are. Christ. Right. Okay? Now, but God's not done. He's not done with Israel. He just simply not. Think about, just, you know, kind of step back for a minute. Take a quick inventory. How many Amorites do you know today? How many Jebusites? Perizzites? You'll find a few termites, but you don't know who I'm talking about, right? Where are those people groups? They've been absorbed into other groups as times went on. Babylonians, Persians. The ethnicity does exist, but it's no longer what it was. All right? Can you find Jews? You can. They're still around as a people. Now that's one. That's the first thing. That's miraculous. Secondly, and this is all anecdotal, circumstantial, but what group of people make up 0.002 of the world's population that's hated the most? Jewish people. Why down through the ages have, though there have been other people, other groups, you know, been attempted to wipe out, but why have the Jews been the target of many wanting to exterminate them? Even right now, what does Iran want to do with a little bitty nation about the size of New Jersey that's 1,000 miles from them? What do they want to do?
Wipe them out.
They want to wipe them out. Why is it that our presidents have tried in vain to develop a two-state solution? Why has that always failed? Hamas does not want a two-state solution, nor does the Palestinian Authority. What do they want? They want a one-nation. They want a one-nation solution, which is them. What do you think the phrase "from the river to the sea" means? Sure, you know what that means, right? Now this is you know, pointing this kind of stuff out. Okay, now back. If we went back to the 1920s, before the Depression, just back in the roaring 20s, and you'd go to a seminary, and you'd interview professors and talk to them about what now tell me about the Jews. And they would say, what are you talking about? Yeah, they're still an ethnic people, but you know, the biblical prophecies talking about a homeland and all that kind of stuff, obviously that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. But it hadn't happened. The Jews had not had a homeland for 2,000 years. And then in May of 1948, what happens? That's miraculous. And granted, I'm just giving you bits and pieces, and you could try to, and there'd be some that would argue each point and suggest an alternative to each point. I know that. But when you couple that with Scripture, you begin seeing something, don't you? Especially if the calling and the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. Meaning what Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were promised, what David was promised. God, who cannot lie, will bring it to completion. So, when you consider biblical prophecy, you're looking at the Bible, you need to keep in mind not America. What you need to keep in mind is that little bitty piece of real estate off the coast of, on the east coast of the Mediterranean, surrounded by all of those enemies that want to destroy her as a nation. You need to keep that in mind. All right. I think that keeps us better on track. Jesus is talking to who? Or whom? He's talking to his disciples. What ethnicity are they? Jews. Where are they living? Yeah. So I think it's helpful. Not everybody will agree with that, and that's okay. But I think it fits. Now Jesus in verse 29, immediately after the distress in those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not shed its light, and stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of heavens will be shaken. Then, okay, all right, we're looking to the when here, aren't we? When are these things? When will be the sign of your coming? When? Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky. Then all the peoples of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Who's already talked about this? Daniel. Daniel has talked about this. As a matter of fact, when Jesus makes this statement before the Sanhedrin, they're done. They're done with him. The high priest rips his garment and says, what need of any other testimony do we need? You heard it from his own mouth. What did Jesus say to the high priest that so issued that kind of response? Tell us plainly, are you the Son of God? Actually, he says, are you the Son of the Blessed One? And Jesus responds, and you will see the Son of Man descending from heaven on the... He says it. They know exactly what he means. That's what Jesus says here. He identifies himself as that one that Daniel spoke about. The one that comes. The Son of Man. Okay. All right. And come in power and great glory. He will send out his angels with a loud trumpet, and they will gather the elect from the four winds and from the end of the sky to the other. So now he's answering the questions. When? Well, this is when. This is when. Now he's not telling them, he's not giving them a calendar date. So anytime, this really is worth the price of admission tonight. Anytime someone shows up and says, Jesus is coming on X day, that day, whatever that day is, you can dismiss that person as being false. Right out of hand. They're lying.
they do not know. It's amazing to me how some people are so gullible that even when their prophet is wrong, they still follow that prophet. One of the ones, I don't know, Bob, you might remember this. In 1988, did you get the little booklet in the mail, 88 Reasons Why Jesus is going to Come in 88? You remember that one? I remember that one. Because I was just a pastor in a little bitty church, and, you know, if I got mail, it tickled me. And I got that, you know. And I remember looking through it, you know, and he had all these lists, 88 reasons. Well, guess what happened? 1989 came. And then he issued his second volume. He missed one. Well, he lost all credibility. You can buy those for $1 a copy. I mean, you could really, you know, stock up on it. And then, of course, Harold Camping is the most recent person he's dead now. But he had, I think, at least three different times he gave a date. And some of his followers would actually sell everything. And if Benny Hinn ever gives a date, his followers are going to go out and buy everything. So they won't have to pay for it, do you see? I thought that would be a funnier joke than that. All right.
Okay. Now, learn the parable of the fig tree.
Learn a lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its branches become tender and it sprouts leaves, you know that summer is near. Well, you know that. You know when the grass greens up and the buds start coming, and you look at the calendar, of course, but you know, hey, it's April. Flowers are starting to pop up. Summer's coming, right? In the same way, when you see all these things, recognize that He is near at the door. Truly, I tell you, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have taken place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away.
Okay, very good. So do you just tell it? When we see these things, be alert enough to know that we're close. He's not telling us when. He's not giving us a specific when, but He's telling us, you know, it's coming close. So there's a lot of things now that would indicate, and again, this is not a calendar date. It's not even a year or a decade that I'm saying this, but some of the things that the Bible does mention that were in the past absolute impossibilities are possible now. And with each passing year, it becomes even more possible. If you have the equipment and the know-how, most likely someone could identify every single one of us in this room from a world away. It's that thing you have in your pocket called a cell phone. Got a GPS in it, and if somebody wants to know, maybe they can find out. The other day, you can get this app on your phone called Find My, and I don't mail my City of Salem bill anymore because I have in the past mailed it, it's shown up late, and I've got a fuss with them because I'm not going to pay a late charge. Now they cut you off, but they change that. So I drop it in. I don't trust the mail anymore. So it was Tuesday. I was going to pay my City of Salem bill. So it was about 3:30 in the afternoon, or 4 o'clock, something like that. I didn't want to park along Main Street this way because you can never get out. The traffic is just a solid line for quite a while, you know, there on Main Street. So I went around the corner. And stopped there, walked around the corner, did the slot, went back in my car, went home. And Tara said, "What were you doing at the ABC?" I said, "I was across the street."
I wasn't at the ABC. Actually, the first thing I said, I was there getting you a hamburger. But rest assured, I was not there. Okay? But she asked that question because I was late getting home. Where was I? Okay. All right. So he tells us this. Now, verses 36 to 44 is very important. Again, when is this going to take place? Now concerning the day and the hour, no one knows, neither the angels in heaven nor the Son, except the Father alone. As in the days of Noah were, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. For in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until Noah entered and boarded the ark. What does that mean? It means life is going on just like it always has.
Yeah.
That's what it means. They did not know until the flood came and swept them away. This is the way the coming of the Son of Man will be. Now I want to back up for a moment because the verse 37 or 36 has been problematic for a lot of folks. You mean Jesus doesn't know? I thought he was God. Isn't that a problem? No, it's not. It's not. Jesus in his humanity did not know at that point. Could he have known? Yeah, he could have known. But and it's not to suggest he doesn't know now. There is something here that escapes us. And what escapes us? A wedding. A Jewish Galilean wedding. How did that work? You didn't send out invitations. What would happen? A young man and a young woman would gather at the city gate, and the fathers would be there, and they would do a negotiation. It's a betrothal. I'm not going to give all the details, but when the agreement was struck, and at that point the documents were signed, the young man and young woman right then and there are married. But they don't go home together. The young woman goes back to her father's house, and the young man goes back to his father's house. And there's going to be a period of time. It will stretch between 9 months and probably 13, 14 months. Something like that. There's going to be a period of time. The young man on the father's house is going to build a room, an addition for his bride. The young woman, she is going to be diligently working, making the plans, getting her dress and any kind of thing to go along with that ready. She, as he, has selected their attendants. After they get into the thing for a while, again, there's no invitation sent. And time goes on. The young man makes preparations. The young woman makes preparations. And they wait. They don't wait idly. They're making preparations and everything like that. Dad, from time to time, is going over inspecting son's work. How's this room coming along, Dad? You better give a little more attention to this area, or something like that. Not quite ready for a bride. And then one day comes, and the father looks at it and says, "Oh, you're done. Not time yet." In all there'll be the bride and her family, and her bridesmaids, the groom and his groomsmen. None of those people know when the wedding's going to take place. Nobody does. Except the groom's father. He knows. He knows. He can do this anytime. It's part of custom. He can do it anytime. Morning, noon, or night, or in the middle of the night. Didn't matter. When he was ready, the father, when he was ready, he would tell his son, "All the preparations are made. All the food is ready. Son, go get your wife." It could be at midnight. Now, the young man would be wide awake when Dad said those words. He would wake up his attendants. They're staying with him, you see, because they don't know when the wedding's going to take place. So they get up and they start hooping and hollering and banging stuff together, just carrying on, making all kinds of racket. And guess what that does? That wakes up everybody around. That's when they know that it's time to go. The wedding feast is going to take place. And the young woman, she's waiting for this. So she's waiting for the shout of the bridegroom, or the friend of the bridegroom, actually, first. Waiting to hear that young man yell. She hears him yell. She's up. She's in her dress already. She's sleeping in it.
Her bridesmaids, they are sleeping in their garb as well. So they waste no time. And then, but see, the point that I'm making here, who makes a decision when it's time? The Father.
So that's what's being mentioned here. Does Jesus know when he's coming back? Of course he does. Of course he does. Now. But he was pointing out there, and he was saying it in a language they understood. When the Father says the time is right, then that's the when. That's when he is, when these things are going to take place. That's when the Father says it's ready, it's time. And when he does that, it's time. And then, but Jesus points out now, he's already been talking about this. Now we go a little bit further. Verse 40. Then two men will be in a field, one will be taken, the other left. Two women will be grinding at with a mill, one will be taken, the other left. Therefore, be alert, since you don't know the day your Lord is coming. But know this, if the homeowner had known what time the thief was coming, he would have stayed alert and not let his house be broken into. This is why you also must be ready, because the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. That's when he's coming. That's when he's coming. So you got to be like a bridesmaid or a bride. You need to be ready. You're not going to have time, perhaps, to get ready. And Jesus uses this figure of speech later about people coming and knocking and then being told, no, you can't come in. But the door is shut. The feast is underway. We're not opening the door. You're late. Now, this idea of... Now, some use this as an expression of perhaps the rapture. Two men in a field, one taken, the other left. Two women grinding, one taken, the other left. Maybe. But another possible option, just think about this. I don't know if it's a good, accurate or not, but it makes sense. One's ready. The other is not. One of the ladies is ready, but the other is not. I don't know, but perhaps that's the kind of... Because that's the context of what we're looking at. Now, the last few verses, and our time is pretty much gone, but our last couple of our few verses. Who then is faithful and the wise servant whom his master will put in charge of his household to give them food at the proper time? Blessed is that servant whom his master finds doing his job when he comes. Truly, I tell you, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But if the wicked servant says in his heart, my master is delayed, and starts to beat his fellow servants and eats and drinks with the drunkards, that servant's master will come at a day in which he does not expect him, at an hour that he does not know, and he will cut him to pieces, assign him a place with the hypocrites, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And we'll return to that again as well a little bit later. Very, very... startling verses, to be sure. I dumped a lot on you, I know. I'll take just a moment. Any questions or comments before I set you free? Yes.
Pastor, it comes to light when it says in verse 37, as it was in the days of Noah. In the days of Noah, there were not many people consecrated. Noah and his family was only saved. So therefore, is it going to be a desolation of our whole world where a lot of people will be totally disintegrated, totally away from the Lord?
Well, there could be implied some of that, but the following verse seems to address what Jesus means there when he says, for in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah boarded the ark. So it seems to suggest that life is just going on like life goes on. There's nothing major, no major change in that respect. He's not really dealing with the religious nature of people.
But it could be definitely implied. I mean, I can't point to it. It will be implied. Chapter 25 will be next time. And it's a challenge. Especially when we get to the judgment of the sheep and the goats, which is the second, last section of chapter 25. It is challenging. All right, I've kept you 5 minutes longer, so read or wrong.
Thank you, Andy.